shopping for as long as they could before the cyber defenses of whatever telecommunications company they'd penetrated got wise to their presence. This is one of only a few instances in which Coles ordered the off-the-books digital services team of their private security contractor to hack into the mobile phones of strangers. He doesn't even know the company's name, and Ed insists they keep it that way. Plausible deniability and all that. But in those other instances, he'd been out to disprove rumors that former employees had stolen proprietary science. And he had, sparing the targets a great deal of trouble and jail time and God knows what other ruin the board would have elected to unleash on them. In other words, he'd used evil for good. Now he's using it because lives have been lost. Ed's highlighted chunks of the transcript in green. Cole holds up a page marked by four different highlights so Ed can see it. What's the theme?
Officers and agents on scene speculating bikers couldn't have pulled it off. They used words like mercenary, special forces, special ops, trained killer. All words that could be associated with Dylan Cody's background. The explosion knocked most of the guys flat, broke some bones on the others, but only killed a few of them. The rest of the work was close-range gunshots. But there's no mention of Dylan. Unless you consider rapid-fire, close-range gunshots delivered minutes after a C4 explosion to be part of his skill set.
It is. Any ID on the bikers in the video he sent?
One of them. The one who got a shotgun blast through his middle did 15 years for aggravated rape. He has a long-standing relationship to the crystal meth community in the American Southwest.
Huge surprise.
And the girl?
We think it's an alias.
An alias?
We matched her image to an Arizona driver's license photo for a woman named Charlotte Rowe, but Charlotte Rowe only popped into existence about a year ago. I want them to keep looking before I show you anything.
I could still use a preliminary report.
They do better work when they think you're waiting and losing patience.
All right, I trust you. Ed nods. It's the closest they'll ever have to a tender moment.
I want the strike team rolling in when we land.
Cole. I don't want them to strike, Ed. I just want a show of force.
You want them rolling in right as we sit down next to the building he's sheltering in?
That could be chaos, Cole. Pageantry, Ed. The word is pageantry.
Fine. You're the one who knows what this guy's capable of.
Ed's baiting him. He doesn't bite. Ed begins tapping instructions into his mobile phone.
So wherever this place is,
Cole asks,
it's not exactly the middle of nowhere?
It's close,
Ed answers.
Just a little ways north of Tucson.
I imagine Tucson would object to being depicted as the middle of nowhere.
I don't know. I've got an aunt there, and she says that's exactly the appeal.
Any idea why he picked this place?
Seems like he'd want to get farther away.
He certainly had enough time. What do you think?
About what? Cole asks.
I'm just saying, you know him a lot better than I do. What's your guess?
More bait. Again, he doesn't bite. He needs Ed, badly.
And if Ed wants to take this moment to express some disapproval of the tortured path Cole and Dylan have walked together, the man's allowed.
There are only a few of Graydon's dark secrets Ed doesn't know, and the ones he doesn't, Dylan knows all too well. Cole can't afford to make an enemy out of Ed or anyone else. Not now. Not today.
Symbolism, he answers.
Symbolism.
The location's going to have some kind of symbolism, that's all I can figure.
Symbolism related to what?
Ed asks.
His beliefs?
Beliefs? The guy's a scientist and a soldier, not a preacher.
Actually, he manages to combine the worst of all three,
he says.
I see,
Ed says.
Well, you'd know.
Ed?
Yes.
Why don't you just ask me what you want to know?
Fine. Is there some kind of involvement between you two that might be clouding your judgment here? That video's real. A meeting like this? We're talking a week of prep, negotiations, at least. This could be an ambush, Cole, and we're flying right into it.
My involvement with Dylan's work is exactly why I'm obligated to take this meeting.
You know what I'm asking. You want to know if he took me out to the Hotel Del Coronado and did things to me that made me forget my own name, is that it?
Ed just stares at him. The man's no homophobe. His reticence probably has more to do with an aversion to discussing his employer's personal life. If Cole's mother were in this seat, Ed would be just as demure on the topic. But can Ed hear what he's really asking? If Cole's judgment around Dylan is warped by libido now, that means it was warped by libido 2 years ago. And 2 years ago, he did a lot worse than rush into an ill-advised, last-minute meeting in the middle of Arizona with a man who might be capable of bending steel with his bare hands. Ed seems to realize this. He slouches back and turns his attention to the view. The Airbus H-155 is supposed to be one of the quietest helicopters millions can buy, but Cole can feel every thump of its rotary blades in his bones. From this altitude, the desert looks like a vast sea whose sandy bottom has been churned up by a global apocalypse, a place without borders or habitation, even though they crossed the California state line only minutes ago. It's not hard to imagine Dylan living out here like some hermit. Correction. It's easy to imagine Dylan living out here like some hermit. Easier than accepting Cole should have been keeping better tabs on the guy. And that he didn't, because the mere thought of Dylan hurt him in ways that suggest Ed Baker's right. His judgment when it comes to Dylan has been clouded. It wasn't the Hotel Del Coronado. It was the Montage in Laguna. Not as historic, but just as luxurious. And yes, on more than one occasion during their visits there, Dylan did make him forget his own name. But Cole had been foolish enough to think theirs was a passion bred by the secrecy of what they'd embarked on together, a fleeting, if white-hot intimacy their special project had produced in them both. If it had occurred to him that Dylan was quite literally playing him like an instrument, such thoughts took a back seat to the shared intensity of their ambitions. Or that's where he tried to shove them so he could justify letting Dylan shatter him in the bedroom. And the great, miserable irony is that Cole's never been one for relationships. He still balks at his mother's insistence that he find some handsome young banker or lawyer to marry. When he was in college, before gay marriage became the law of the land, he delighted in his freedom from the conventions and rituals that seemed poised to doom the ambitions of his fellow Stanford overachievers. His freedom from the reality of some wife's biological clock or her bewildering emotional needs weighing down his potential life's work. Back then, the road ahead had seemed clear of obstructions, an endless stream of professional accomplishment and occasional release at the hands of gorgeous, skilled professionals who made regular appearances on his favorite porn websites. But now he's thinking of that journal his father left for him, the one that mentioned Dylan. To hear his mother tell it, stories of departing presidents leaving behind private letters in the Oval Office for their successors had inspired Cole's father to leave him a series of journals that were essentially long letters addressed to him, solely about the running of his company. Today they fill several thick, leather-bound books Cole keeps in a locked cabinet in his home office. It was in those journals, just days after Dylan's disappearance, that he found a description of Dylan Cody that couldn't have been more accurate. He is as well-versed in the chemical reactions that govern the mind as he is in how the mind can be shaped and manipulated by external factors. He sees the brain not as a flawed, damage-prone instrument meant to be healed, but as something to be maximized, the first phase of a computer application desperately in need of overdue updates. After he finished reading those words, Cole blamed exhaustion and Project Bluebird's humiliating end for the tears he'd shed. Now he's not so sure. 19. His face pressed to the cabin's window, Cole watches the abandoned restaurant grow in size as they come in for a landing. Thanks to the internet, Cole knows that the rest stop, formerly known as Jackie's, is popular now with outdoor explorers, the kind of people who love to take GoPro videos inside empty missile silos flooded with rainwater, and post them to YouTube. The old sign must be 50 feet tall. It rises out of the sand like a monolith, as if it's still desperately trying to grab the attention of motorists on a freeway that ended up moving miles to the east, too far away to supply the place with enough customers to survive. A few of the old neon letters are visible, J.A.C., but most of the signs been gnawed away by the unobstructed winds. The chopper's runners extend from either side of the fuselage with a slight whine. Meanwhile, the strike team pulls into place, 4 shiny black SUVs moving Secret Service-like over the expanse of brown. They kick up rooster tails of dust before fanning out on either side of the restaurant, 3 in front, 1 in back. Although given the place's state of disrepair, the terms front and back seem relative. Only 1 SUV parked behind the place. That tells Cole the back wall's still largely intact, offering limited means of escape. What strikes Cole the most as they land is the absence of any other vehicle, which means Dylan got here on foot, which is a reminder of all the things Dylan's been trained to do. Imagining those skills married to Dylan's wonder drug makes Cole's stomach lurch. Yeah, now that you're not sleeping with him anymore, it doesn't seem like such a great idea, does it? Once they've touched down, Ed slides the passenger compartment door open and goes to step out first. Cole stops him with one hand. When his feet hit the concrete of the old parking lot, he counts the black-clad members of his security team, who've drawn their weapons and aimed them across the hoods of the SUVs. 6 in all, each brandishing a fully loaded Glock. It's the show of force he asked for. Now he plans to offset it a little. Gripping his phone in one hand, he walks in front of them toward the shattered windows and crumbling facade. If the team takes a shot, they'll probably end up hitting Cole first. Dylan emerges from the whale's mouth that used to be the restaurant's front door. He's assembled some ordinary civilian clothes into an effective, if more monochromatic, version of desert camouflage. His shirt and pants are sand-lashed, but he's wiped down his face and hair. Technically, they're out of the security team's earshot, but the recording device under Cole's shirt is also transmitting to a tiny earpiece in Ed's left ear. Cole braces himself. Dylan sinks to his knees and laces his fingers behind his head, as if preparing to be arrested. Cole's fine with the pose. For now. "Where is she?" Cole asks. "Not here." "Who is she?" "You don't already know?" "I know everything about her seems like an alias." "What's her background? She one of your old Special Forces friends?" "There are no woman SEALs. Yet." The implication is clear. His drug could change all that. Project Bluebird could have changed all that, if Cole hadn't pulled the plug. "Who is she, Dylan?" "Keep digging. You'll get to it." "It's more obvious than you think." "Where is she now?" "Out in the world, making the most of my gift. Just as I'd hoped." "Your gift? Are you serious? Your gift is proprietary science that doesn't belong to you." Dylan's gentle laughter is as condescending as a pat on the head. "What are you going to do? Turn me in? Give the Justice Department a tour of your little island lab? Open up your books so everyone can see who was funding us? Did Project Bluebird even have books? Honestly, Let's not waste our time on this petty nonsense. We have far more important things to discuss. Cole surprises himself with the speed of what he does next. He hurls his phone in Dylan's direction. Dylan lashes out with one arm and catches it just in time. The phone doesn't come apart in his hands. No burst of superhuman strength. When Dylan realizes the goal of this gesture, he smiles. "Clever," Dylan says.
"But I haven't made that much progress. You want your phone back?"
"I have other phones." Dylan hurls it at him anyway. Cole catches it with both hands. When he looks over one shoulder, he sees even Ed has his gun drawn now. The rest of the security team are standing with Glocks aimed at Dylan, rather than braced across the hoods of their vehicles. Cole gestures for them to stand down. They all comply, except for Ed. He doesn't move an inch.
"Why here?" Cole asks.
"Think." There's no hint of malice in Dylan's expression, not even a hint of challenge. But there never is. He's smart enough to make someone believe personal destruction is in their best interests.
"I'm not an Arizona historian, Dylan. But you know history is the reason we're here, which means you know me. So think. Why would I pick this place?"
"Think back on our relationship," is what he's saying. "Think back on all the conversations we had. All the private moments we shared together. Moments I was willing to throw away completely as soon as you cut off my funding so more volunteers wouldn't die." Luckily, Cole doesn't have to. He knew the answer after a brief web search. He knew the answer when Ed asked him the question on the flight. But to say so would have meant admitting to a level of intimacy he wasn't ready to reveal to Ed just yet. Still, he scans their surroundings to see if there's some clue that might suggest his first guess is wrong. Just behind Dylan, great shafts of dusty sunlight stream through the restaurant's ruined ceiling, falling across the scattered rows of booths inside. Stacked against the hold-filled walls are piles of rotting chairs and sun-bleached cushions pulled from the booths. The booths were red leather once, Cole assumes. Now most of them are bone white. The preservative effects of the dry desert air have done a steady battle with the wind and whatever other forces have passed through this place, taking bites along the way. To the east is the slight downhill grade Ed mentioned. The freeway is so far away it's almost impossible to see the sunlight winking off the roofs of passing cars. But if the map he studied before he left is to be believed, somewhere down there is Aravaipa Creek.
"Grant's Massacre," Cole says.
Dylan smiles. He gets to his feet, slowly, brushing the sand from his knees.
140 Apache women murdered and scalped by a coalition of natives, Anglos, and Mexicans. Mutilated. Another testament to mankind's bewildering appetite for inflicting suffering. There were political reasons for the attack. There is never a political reason for mutilating anyone. The federal government was reducing the money they provided to ensure peace between merchants and the natives, especially the Apache. The merchants were afraid they wouldn't have the goods to pacify the tribes. It set the stage for the attack. I'm not saying it justifies it. Nonsense. Women and children scalped and mutilated in their beds. It was sexual sadism. No different from this mask maker in Los Angeles. I just didn't have the word for it yet.
"Do you have other women?" Cole asks. Dylan cocks his head to one side as if he's waiting for Cole to finish this question.
"Out in the field, I mean," Cole adds. "Enjoying your gift?"
"Just one.
The one you saw. Did you test it on any others?"
"Yes."
"How many?"
"One."
"Not Charlotte Rowe,
The girl I saw on the tape.
No.
Did you sleep with them?
The first girl, yes. Not Charlotte.
Cole regrets asking the question as much as he regrets the blush Dylan's answer brings to his cheeks.
I told you, Dylan says. I don't adhere to popular labels in that area.
There is no popular label for someone whose sexual identity is entirely professional ambition.
Well, there is, but they don't give them out at Harvard.
What are you accusing me of, Cole?
The first girl. The one it didn't work on. Is she dead?
Yes.
Cole feels his pulse beating in the side of his face. Amazing that this news, amid the rest of it, makes him feel like he's breathing through a straw. Dylan's expression is blank. He studies Cole as if whatever emotional reaction Cole will have to this information is a tiresome but necessary inconvenience. But Cole isn't seeing Dylan anymore. He's seeing video footage he long since destroyed, footage of a decorated war hero chewing on his right arm after he'd torn it from his body and beaten himself with it until one of his legs broke.
My money, he thinks. My money funded all that bloodshed, all those scenes I can't erase from my nightmares. All of it, thanks to my money. My father's money.
They'd come up with a phrase for it, for the swift orgy of relentless, cannibalistic self-destruction that consumed all four test subjects within minutes of their trigger events. Going lichen. If only they had truly become something else in those final moments. Another creature. Not a wide-eyed, howling human suddenly programmed to quite literally tear itself apart in a frenzied rage. Did it matter that they were willing volunteers? That they knew the risks? That the last two had actually watched videos of what had happened to the first two and still agreed to take the drug? These facts had comforted him some back then. Back then, he thought he'd put a stop to it by shutting the project down. He never thought Dylan capable of taking the nightmares they'd seen in that lab out into the world.
Do you need to sit? Dylan asks.
Fuck you, Cole whispers. Dylan nods and looks away, waiting, it seems, for Cole to collect himself.
So this first girl,
Cole asks.
She went lichen?
She knew the risks.
I told her I wouldn't let her suffer. I kept my promise.
So you were wrong. It had nothing to do with the gender of the subjects. And even though I forbade you to test it on women, you went out and did it anyway.
You forbade me to test it on women because you are a sexist and you have mommy issues.
I put a stop to it because I was tired of watching people tear themselves apart.
I see. So it was just an excuse then.
So you could fire me because you'd finally panicked. Give me a break. You didn't care about those volunteers. You cared about exposure. I didn't fire you. I cut the funding for a project that ended in disaster, and if you remember correctly, it wasn't just my call to make.
Don't worry. I remember our partners quite well.
You were one of our most brilliant scientists, Dylan. I could have put you on something else the next day.
Oh, on what? Some anti-anxiety drug that's just going to trank people into functional oblivion? I was trying to create survivors, not blissed-out drones.
But you didn't.
Until now.
And you killed a woman to do it, which makes you a monster.
And you, as always, are a revolutionary pretending to be a shill. The conflict will drive you mad, Cole, I guarantee it.
Because I'm not willing to kill any more people in the name of your research?
You don't have to.
He extends his arms and gives Cole a bright smile.
You have a successful test subject.
And she's already killed someone.
I'd say that's an unfair reading of what happened on that video, wouldn't you?
She was protecting herself from two thugs who were probably going to rape her,
and leave her for dead in the middle of the desert. Forgive the absence of tears. Where is she, Dylan? She won't be that hard for you to find if you reactivate the consortium. Cole's barely been able to say this name aloud to himself in the 2 years since Project Bluebird ended. It's easier to remember those horrifying videos of their test subjects than it is to recall the weight of responsibility these secret partners brought to bear on him. The idea that Dylan could so casually call for its reactivation is as offensive as everything else he's said and done these past few days. Maybe even more so.
Are you out of your fucking mind? You want me to call up 5 defense contractors, all of whom still lie awake at night worrying the results of your project will come back to haunt them, by the way, and what? Invite them to brunch? Tell them you've set a successful test subject loose in the world with your drug? How exactly do you think they'll respond?
Managing the consortium has always been your responsibility. I prefer to stick to the science. Our relationship works better that way. We are not in a relationship. I understand that you're hurting, Cole. I understand that I caused some of that pain when I left so quickly. But deep down, you know I truly don't give a single red fuck. That I consider your pain to be an inconvenience and a distraction from a goal far more important than anything your heart might think it wants. And if there's anyone who should know the importance of prioritizing objectives over feelings, it's the head of Graydon Pharmaceuticals. If you think for one second that my contempt for you in this moment has anything to do with the fact that you got me to bottom in a couple of hotel rooms, you are even more of a delusional narcissist than I thought. What you have done is irresponsible and reprehensible, and it might bring a show of force down upon your head that not even I can stop.
A show of force worse than this? Dylan asks, gesturing to the phalanx of guns.
A lot worse.
Dylan nods sagely, as if Cole were offering up this information as part of a deal point, and not a warning, and he's decided to accept.
Gender might not have anything to do with it, Dylan begins, ignoring the bitter laughter that comes from Cole when he realizes Dylan has reverted to a scientific lecture. With Charlotte, I pursued another theory, and it looks like it's paid off.
Dylan checks to make sure Cole is still listening. Then he slowly walks around behind him, turning his back to the security team. He's making himself a better target, but he's also concealing his hands and any weapon he might draw, and blocking Cole from the strike team's view while he does it. It's a test, Cole's sure, to see how willing he is to hear more about the science of Dylan's latest experiment. Cole turns.
Dylan continues. You see, with our male volunteers, what we thought was their strength turned out to be their liability, their combat experience. The trauma of it reshaped their amygdalae in ways too subtle to detect on an MRI. That's where the aggression, the self-destruction, came from. My first female subject, she had a similar trauma in her past and most likely similar amygdalar deformation.
But Charlotte's different.
Charlotte grew up in proximity to great physical trauma, but it was never directly inflicted upon her. Her wounds, they're psychological. All of this will make more sense once you dig into her past, which I'm confident you'll do, despite your protests. But my point is that Charlotte Rowe is exactly the type of subject the current version of the drug works on. A vigilante spirit without the actual physical wounds that it usually takes to create a vigilante. Her mind and her past set the stage for exactly what we've always been shooting for. A panic response from the primitive brain that doesn't shut down the frontal cortex. You've seen the tape. She doesn't tunnel. She doesn't freeze or go into quiescence, but her fear is real. The drug's done exactly what it's supposed to do. It's harnessed the power of her fear to almost perfect mental acuity,
and the byproduct is the same level of physical strength we saw in our old subjects, only without the self-destruction. Now the challenge is figuring out exactly how it works in her and duplicating the results in a wider variety of subjects.
What about her blood? Are there traces of paradrenaline?
I'll find out.
You haven't taken her blood?
A lot's happened very quickly. Is he being coy, or has he lost access to this woman? Dylan had performed early animal tests himself, videos of which he'd brought to Cole to snare his interest. In those first non-human subjects, the ones who hadn't torn themselves to shreds, the drug had somehow tricked the adrenal glands into making a variant of adrenaline never before documented in an organic life form. It was the most astonishing and otherworldly aspect of Zapraxin, that its functioning in the brain somehow keyed the body into synthesizing an entirely new hormone. A hormone that produced bursts of superhuman strength, especially when you considered that unleashing superhuman strength in the body had never been Dylan's intention. He'd set out to increase mental functioning during moments of extreme terror, and only as a means of preventing panic or paralysis. But in the end, it was like he'd created something akin to an antidepressant that had the unexpected side effect of allowing people who took it to grow wings and fly several miles. Paradrenaline was their name for this new, previously undocumented hormone. And while there'd been traces of it in the bodies of the human subjects who had torn themselves apart, the samples had degraded too rapidly after the subjects' deaths to be preserved in a lab. Worse, the samples taken from animal test subjects had produced no effect in humans. The idea that there was someone out there now whose system might be flush with it made Cole's head spin with genuine excitement for the first time since the helicopter had touched down. Zypraxin aside, there was no telling what paradrenaline might be able to do under the right circumstances, what it might be able to power, to heal.
On that tape. She's running from you, isn't she?
Cole asks. Dylan looks as if he's been slapped. Cole tries to suppress a smile and fails.
That camera, Cole continues. It wasn't yours. You stole it from those bikers on the tape, didn't you? And my guess is she was running from you when she ran into them, wasn't she?
Dylan swallows. Cole's never seen the man so thrown off his game, and he allows himself a second or two to take pleasure in it.
The situation was more complex than that, Dylan whispers. This wasn't your plan to send her out into the world like this. You lost her, and now you want us to get her back.
There were unexpected variables, but no, I did not lose her.
And I don't need you to get her back.
She won't be that hard to find once you activate the consortium. She needs to be constantly monitored to see what she'll do. The results will be beneficial to us all.
Why was she running?
Cole asks.
As I said, there were unexpected Why was she running away from you, Dylan? What did you do? Lie to her? Trick her into taking the drug because you couldn't bring yourself to tell her what had happened to your last subjects? What did you do to this woman?
I put the power of gods in her hands. Cole's never seen the man's passion take this angry a form.
That's what I did to her. Charlotte Rowe is now patient zero for a benevolent virus that could wipe out sexual sadism, rape, and domestic violence, and if you don't make every effort to watch everything she does with what I've given her, you will be missing out on the scientific breakthrough of the century.
You think that video is my endgame? I want this drug perfected, balanced, made available to the world, just like I did when we started. And I can't do that without you or Graydon or the consortium. And you can't come within an inch of matching your father's legacy if you don't make a breakthrough like this, and you know it. It's why you're here. But if you don't help me, I'll destroy every pill I have left. In fact, if you decide to keep me here now,
All the pills I have left and all the documentation of every adjustment I've made to the formula since I left you will be incinerated before you can get to them. Trust me. If only I could read minds, Cole thinks. But even if I could, I'd still have trouble reading his. So many distractions. So many memories. Is he lying about making adjustments to the drug post-Project Bluebird? Maybe. Is he really capable of testing the same drug that had caused 3 subjects to go lichen on another human being without making at least some small adjustments to the formula? If the answer's no, then there's still some vestige of the man Cole gave his body to so recklessly and frequently. If the answer's yes, then he's a straight-up monster, and Cole should have him shot down where he stands. Yeah, but Zyprexin, though. If it's working now... I don't trust you, is all Cole can manage. On this particular matter, you should. I never would have asked for this meeting if I didn't have something to hold over you, and you know it. When did you adjust the formula? After I left? And after you killed your first woman? Dylan just stares at him. You didn't make any adjustments before you tested it on Charlotte Rowe. Like I said, I had a different theory. You were counting on her to have a different brain? Dylan just stares at him. Shoot him, Cole thinks. Shoot him right now. Anyone who could give that pill to an unsuspecting person after watching someone tear themselves apart. It works, Cole, Dylan whispers, as if he can read Cole's thoughts. I was right. It works. And whether you can admit it or not, you want to know why. You have to know. We both do. After a deep but quiet breath, Dylan continues. No amount of social progress will ever change the average difference in physical strength between the genders. It must be leveled with biochemistry. And until it is, the most persistent and insidious crimes in our society will continue day in and day out across the globe. And your mother will still be dead, Cole says. Yes. And cheap pop psychology will still be incapable of distracting me from my goals. We're in agreement there. Activate the consortium, Cole. Enlist their surveillance technologies. Hell, they could use it as a chance to test something new of theirs. But if you tell them the truth, if you tell them everything I've told you and you show them the video, they'll see the potential. They'll see we can't miss a minute of this. This is everything we've been working toward. Is this all aging is? Cole wonders. The discovery that a lapse in judgment like the one he showed with Dylan could have a lasting ripple effect. Or is he just blaming Dylan for the fact there's a part of him that doesn't want to give up on Project Bluebird either? These are private thoughts, not to be even mulled over in Dylan's presence. God knows the man's smart enough to detect them and use them to his advantage, no matter how silent Cole remains. Cole starts to leave. My guess is she's in a town called Altamira, Dylan says. Just south of Big Sur, west of the 101 freeway in the adjacent valley. This news stops Cole in his tracks, which he's pretty sure was Dylan's intention. So you don't need us to find her? She'll use the Praxin again, mark my words. And when she does, that's when we convince her to come in for testing, and that's when you get those vials of para-adrenaline you've always been after. And if I just bring her in now and get whatever I want from her? You won't. Why not? Because you're not me. Is that a compliment or an insult? She's had one successful run. On the 3rd or 4th, she could go lichen just like the others. There's no telling. Better to hang back and see how she performs. See if she's worth tipping your hand to. Because if she's not, and you bring her in and reveal everything we've done, there's only one way to be rid of her, and you're not very good at letting people die. Some people call it murder. Dylan doesn't answer. Cole can feel surrender in his bones, can feel it relaxing his limbs and his posture, and possibly his face before he can stop it. Which gives him no choice but to continue past Dylan and start for the helicopter. The engine chugs as the rotary blades begin to spin. Cole. He turns.
It's good to be working with you, again, Dylan says.
Suck my dick, Cole answers with a smile. Again. Then he heads for the helicopter, with Ed on his heels. They've just flown back over the state line into California, when Ed lets out a startled grunt. Since they've boarded, he's been listening to his recording of Cole and Dylan's conversation with noise-canceling headphones. A few minutes ago, something inspired him to start a web search on his phone, and now he's eager for Cole to see the results. Cole takes the phone. Instantly, he recognizes the face that accompanies the article. It's like seeing an old college classmate, someone who was familiar to him on a daily basis for a short period of his past, but has since vanished from his life entirely. This isn't one of his Stanford classmates, however. Her hair's completely different now, her face longer and more adult. But she's the girl in the video.
It's Burning Girl. That explains everything, Ed says.
Not everything, Cole answers. And Ed says nothing. Maybe because he knows. Cole's right. 20. When Luke was in college, he didn't know the meaning of a day off. Days off were for other people. People who didn't have life plans. People who didn't use wipe-off pens to turn one window of their dorm rooms into a running list of both daily and weekly tasks and objectives. If he didn't have class, he was studying or working one of two jobs, or he was in the gym. Holidays, especially the long ones, were spent doing prep work for whatever classes he was planning to take the following semester. It always gave him a thrill to walk into a language course already fluent in basic conversational phrases.
Yeah, how'd that work out for you, hotshot? You're really wowing Mona with your Mandarin, aren't you?
He's not too crazy about days off now, either. Especially since his job feels like a monotonous grind that only uses a third of his available mental energy. When he shelves his badge after a long week, he doesn't feel the kind of bone-deep exhaustion and satisfaction he associates with hard work. Instead, he feels restless and bored. A slug of Heineken should help. When his cell phone rings, he jumps, spilling beer down the front of his shirt. He grabs for it, expecting to see Mona's name on the caller ID, but he doesn't recognize the number.
Howdy, hometown hero, Marty says when Luke answers. Okay. We can go with that, I guess. Still want to see Trina?
Luke stands, brushing beer foam from the front of his t-shirt.
I'd like to be in touch with her, yeah, but I didn't say I could. You're renting the old Hickman place, right? Yeah, but we'll be there in 20 minutes.
Wait.
Now? No, not now. 20 minutes. Yeah, I'm not really ready to receive visitors. Just brush off the Cheetos dust and put the porn away. She's not expecting high tea, for Christ's sake. I'm not watching porn. And it's not gonna be visitors, plural, just her. I'm gonna wait outside in case you start wailing on each other.
For some reason, Marty cracks up like this is the funniest joke anyone's ever made.
Yeah, or maybe this evening I can meet her in town or something and we can grab a cup of coffee or a... What's your problem, Jack? Do you want to make this right or not?
Marty barks.
She's in town. She doesn't have much time and she's willing to see you. Isn't this what you wanted?
Why doesn't she have much time?
Ask her yourself. In 20 minutes. Marty? Oh, and by the way, she changed her name. Goes by Charlie now.
Okay?
You know, probably because of people like you.
Marty hangs up. Luke reaches for his beer and downs the remainder of it. Whoever said you can't go home again was just engaging in a bunch of wishful thinking. As Marty drives, Charlotte studies the pill in her palm. Up close and in broad daylight, she can see the wrongness of it, the lumpiness that suggests it didn't come off a factory assembly line. In Dylan's office, she'd been distracted by too many things to notice the strangeness of the pills or the cheapness of their packaging.
Take it,
Marty says.
Soothe an old man's nerves.
You're not that old, she says.
Come on, Charlie. You don't want me busting in on your old high school bully with guns blazing, do you?
I don't want to waste a pill over something that's probably not true.
What, you got big plans for the rest?
We've been over this.
Not really. I mean, I get it. It's important what they can do. Maybe they could help people in the right hands. Only problem is the hand that gave it to you doesn't seem like one of those hands.
I'm having a hard time believing Luke Prescott is in on this, Marty.
You had no idea Dylan was in on it, did you? And you still don't really have any idea what it even is.
Ouch. Fine. She swallows the pill as if it were an Advil and turns her attention to the road. They'd arrived in darkness early that morning, after which she'd slept until noon, occasionally roused by the sounds of Marty moving about the house, having low conversations with guys who'd dropped by throughout the morning, other sober men he'd enlisted to help protect her.
I've kept their secrets. It's not asking much of them to return the favor,
Marty told her. Each time she woke, this thought comforted her enough to send her back to sleep. By the time she'd woken up for good, the only one in the kitchen was Marty, hiding his sleeplessness behind a cup of coffee and a warm smile. It's just the two of them now as they drive the winding road from Marty's property to the valley floor. To call his house a mobile home wouldn't do it justice. It always looks freshly painted, and he long ago added redwood decks on all sides, a vegetable garden, and a row of poplar trees around the perimeter that give a watery luminescence to the dry, grassy hills surrounding his property. Marty, I don't want it to sound like I don't appreciate what you're doing.
It doesn't, now that you took the pill.
He gives her a cockeyed grin. No matter what happens, you don't have to put your life in danger for me.
I know. I don't have to do any of the shit I do, except, you know, shit, and eat, and sleep, and drink water. I do stuff 'cause I want to, 'cause it matters to me.
Because you matter to me, is what he's saying. She reaches across the gear shift and squeezes his knee briefly to let him know he matters to her, too. The Hickman place is on the opposite side of the valley from Marty's, on Lowell Drive, a serpentine street that branches off from State Mountain Road 293. It hugs the inland base of the mountains that stretch all the way to PCH, so there are more trees here than around Marty's place, and they dapple the large, unfenced lots and their tiny houses with deep pools of shadow. In another hour or so, the sun will disappear behind the Santa Lucia Mountains, even though there's hours to go before dusk. The old Hickman place, a ranch-style house with a gently sloping roof and a front room that juts out onto its unkempt front lawn, is a ghost of its former self. It used to be one of the nicest homes in town, built and owned for as long as she could remember by the family who started the local drugstore on Center Street. But the store's gone, and so are the Hickmans, including their daughter, Emily, who'd made it a point to invite Charlotte to all the pool parties she had in high school. Parties where Charlotte remembers feeling fairly welcome and not too openly stared at. Probably because Luke wasn't there drumming up contempt for her among the other guests. while the oak tree out back is just as impressive as it used to be, and the view beyond just as beautiful, the above-ground pool is long gone, and so's the tall cast-iron fence to which the family used to tie strings of blue and pink balloons. At first, she assumes the man who appears on the stoop can't be Luke Prescott. He's too tall, too broad. But of course, she's comparing him to the high school version, which is nuts. He's got the same military-grade buzz cut that makes his sandy blonde hair look like it's painted on his skull. But his face is wider now, his features more evenly balanced. That constant squinting expression, which always made him look like he was getting ready to say something biting and sarcastic, even on those rare occasions he wasn't, is gone now. And she can't help but wonder if there were other things she read into his personality based on ephemeral aspects of his physical appearance. Or you're cutting him too much slack because this new body of his is something to see. And how'd things go the last time you got distracted by a man's looks? Luke gives them a stiff wave and an even stiffer, more awkward smile. Marty rolls the window down.
You sure you don't want to come in, Marty?
Luke asks.
Sure, Sam.
Who's Sam? He asks.
It's just an expression. It is?
Luke asks. No, Charlotte says, stepping from the truck. It isn't. Marty shoots her an angry look, but it shows her how nervous he is. He really does believe Luke might be some sort of threat, and he's not sure this is the best way to handle it. We'll be fine, Charlotte whispers, then gives him a peck on the cheek. It was a deliberate strategy, surprising Luke in the middle of the day at home like this. Marty insisted on it. And it's clear Luke is bothered by her sudden arrival, but who wouldn't be? It's the inside of his house that'll tell her the most. How lived in is it? Is this stay, this new job, temporary? Like all crazy conspiracy theories, there's no surefire way to disprove Marty's idea that Luke might be some sort of secret agent, part of a vast conspiracy that includes Dylan Thorpe and the pills. But the state of Luke's life might offer up some helpful bits of evidence.
Charlie?
He says with a respectful nod, avoiding her stare. Luke, she answers.
Place looks different. You and Emily were friends?
She invited me to some of her parties. We weren't besties or anything.
I see.
Believe it or not, she adds, I actually got invited places back then. She never believes people when they claim their angry words just slipped out. But in this instance, these angry words did, in fact, just slip out. But she managed to hold back the punchline, which would have been something along the lines of, despite your best efforts, you jerk.
We didn't have any parties, he says.
But he's looking at her feet, and his flaring nostrils suggest embarrassment and nervousness. That's not what I meant. I wasn't talking about your family, I
know what you meant.
A bird cries somewhere in the distance. A San Francisco-bound jetliner has begun its descent over the valley, and she'd rather stare at it for the remainder of the day than spend another awkward moment on this scraggly front lawn.
So, Marty says you didn't have much time to see me. What, are you just passing through or something?
Luke finally asks. Something like that.
You got time for a beer?
I got time for a Diet Coke.
You always were big on Diet Coke.
This feels like bait, and she's not willing to take it. What's he trying to do, sell her on the idea that he was always sweet on her and his constant bullying was just his way of dealing with the fact that he liked her? Does anyone really believe that crap anymore? Even if it's true, how's she supposed to feel about it now? Grateful for the attention, no matter how negative it was? And if he was paying enough attention to her to know her favorite beverage, could he not see how much his constant insults hurt her? Somewhere out there, she thinks, There must be a man who wasn't raised to believe his every cough in a woman's presence is somehow a gift to her. If Marty hadn't sent her here with a clear objective, she might be giving voice to these thoughts. But instead, she's chewing her bottom lip in an effort to keep her expression neutral.
I don't have any Diet Coke, he says.
Okay.
I mean, I don't drink it. If I'd known you were coming, I'd have run out and bought some.
I get it. We surprised you.
No, that's fine. I mean, if you're only in town for a short while, I'm glad you came by.
Let's go inside, Luke. His cheeks are ablaze. The sight pleases her for many reasons, some of them too complicated for her to sort through in this moment. He gestures to the front door. She follows him into the house. 21. The inside of the house, like the yard, has a hollowed-out feeling that makes memories of those long-ago parties ring in her mind. The place is mostly empty, except for the den, which looks as if a bachelor pad apartment has been slid through the front door intact and then wedged into this one room. There's a flat-screen TV resting on top of a chest of drawers that looks like it belongs in a dorm. The bookshelves on either side are too small. The hunter green curtains don't match the yellow walls, and she doesn't see the color anywhere else in the house. Across the entry hall, in the dining room, cardboard boxes are shoved neatly against one wall, three rows deep. There's no real mess, but it's clear most of Luke's belongings are still inside, and he just moves between them to retrieve his essentials. In one corner of the room, there's a mostly empty desk and a desktop computer. Its widescreen monitor pulses with a succession of high-definition images. Snowy mountains, sparkling lakes, the peaks of the Scottish Highlands. When she turns and sees the new alarm panel on the wall behind her, she remembers her own back in Arizona, and the sting of betrayal threatens to distract her. Luke's surroundings don't fit with either of the two scenarios she was on the lookout for. The eruptive mess of someone who's hit a brick wall in life, or the too immaculate, too orderly domicile of someone who hasn't fully committed to their new home, maybe because they don't plan to stay for very long. What she sees is something in between the two. Order and a lack of commitment, and an awkward marriage of his grad school life and his new, uncertain one. But who is she to try to analyze this house and his stuff in this way? She's not a detective, for Christ's sake. This thought gives her a second or two of relief before she remembers that if she's going to survive the mess she's currently in, she better acquire the skills of a detective, and quick.
You like Sprite?
He asks. Sure, as long as it's diet. Luke nods and ducks into the kitchen. She doesn't follow, but she's got a good vantage point from where she's standing. Almost nothing on the counters. No blender, no toaster. Just a coffee maker and a stack of mail. The butcher block table's too small, just like everything in the house is too small. He didn't plan to live here, she thinks. That's all I can figure. Luke returns with an open can of Sprite Zero and nothing for himself, which makes her feel awkward and like she shouldn't take a sip. But he wasn't out of her sight for more than a second, and would he really drug her with Marty outside? If he did, would she be as immune as she'd been to the vodka and wine she'd guzzled the night before? Or is that something that only happens after Dylan's wonder drug has been triggered? There's still a part of her that wants to refer to the drug as Zyprexin. But she'd like to know if the name, like much of what Dylan told her, is complete bullshit. So, what brought this on? She asks, gesturing to the room around her.
I needed a place to live. It's cheap, believe it or not. Silvershore was renting it out for some of their foremen on the resort project, but when that fell through, they broke their lease, and Emily was desperate to fill the place. Her dad's been gone a while.
No, I mean asking to see me like this.
Marty didn't tell you?
He said you were with the sheriff's department now, that's all. She lies. Luke nods. This is not a secret agent, she realizes. Or if he is, he's super bad at it, because right now I could cut his discomfort with a knife. And he might thank me if I did. Then she sees the stack of books on the shelf.